Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, May 24th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Holly Pretzky from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll be joined by WCAI reporter Sarah Mises-Tam. And now a look at some of the news around the Cape and the islands. Kristen, a state study 5 years in the making calls for new Cape bridges and major changes to connecting roads. It's not a big surprise, but it is an ambitious vision.
Yes, so the Massachusetts Department of Transportation has recommended replacing the Sagamore and Bourne bridges, along with a number of other changes in the roads that are leading up to access those bridges. Those recommendations are contained in a draft of the department's Cape Cod Canal Transportation Study, which was released Tuesday. And as we all know, that area around the canal is notorious for traffic, especially in the summer, which is kind of a good point that we're talking about this now at the start of the summer season here. Those 83-year-old bridges still stand, but another issue is that they fall well behind modern design standards, and they need more extensive repairs more frequently in order to remain standing there. The recommendations were based on the assumption that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers would replace the bridges. And if that happens, the new bridges would be much larger than the existing 40-foot wide bridges.
Much larger.
Yes.
They're talking about. So they're 48 feet wide now, you're saying. Tell us how big they're thinking they could go to.
So the department is envisioning a structure of up to 138 feet wide, and the bridges could have a total of 6 12-foot wide lanes, a 10-foot wide median, a 12-foot wide shared use path, and 6-foot sidewalks on either side, and there'd also be a 10-foot buffer between traffic and the sidewalks. So definitely a much more expansive structure than we see now when we go over the bridges.
Almost three times as wide, right?
Yes. So on Monday, the Massachusetts congressional delegation filed a bill that could allocate funding for the replacement of bridges as part of an evacuation route rehabilitation plan. The replacement of the bridges will fall largely to the federal government, and the cost has been estimated at around $1 billion. The bridges are owned by the Army Corps of Engineers, and the changes to the bridges would prompt alterations to a lot of the roads leading to them. The study recommended building a highway interchange to replace the Bourne Rotary. Vehicles would get on Route 28 directly from Sandwich Road or Trowbridge Road, and local traffic would go directly over Route 28 on an overpass. The interchange would cut congestion on roads that lead to the existing rotary, but the state would have to acquire small parcels of land around that area. The department is also proposing a creation of a westbound ramp to Route 25 to cut down on the number of motorists that are going into the Belmont Circle near the Bourne Bridge. The traffic circle there would also get a makeover with three spurs and an intersection with a traffic signal near the ramp to Route 25.
I had to go on Google Maps yesterday as I was reading through this to try to visualize exactly what they're explaining, because this and also what they're proposing at the Sagamore, there's a lot of new connections.
Yes, a lot of new connections, a lot of changes to things that have been there for a long time that people are very familiar with. There's another suggestion to move exit 1C from the foot of the south side of the Sagamore Bridge to a utility corridor in Sandwich that's kind of south of where its current location is now. The new exit would connect Route 6 to Route 6A and the Route 130 intersection. And there, in the summer, the traffic can back up nearly 5 miles at that exit because drivers are waiting for their chance to get on the bridge there. There's also another addition would be an eastbound lane for about 3.5 miles between the Sagamore Bridge and Exit 2. The new bridge is envisioned to have auxiliary lanes, so this additional lane on Route 6 would kind of prevent a bottleneck as drivers are getting off the bridge there. None of the proposals, as you mentioned, are surprises. There's been a working group that's held several public meetings over the last few years, and some people have been pushing for this option that the study recommended for quite a while, but it's still kind of far from a final decision. The Army Corps is working on another study to look at whether the bridges should go through a refurbishment or be replaced. That's expected to be finished by mid to late summer, but officials have already said the Corps is kind of leaning toward that replacement, so it wouldn't be a surprise if the recommendation came through there to replace the bridges.
Kind of interesting, one of the officials here, Tom Kay here, the administrator for the Cape Cod Regional Transit Authority, saying that all of this is great and really working in the direction we need to work, but in the end, it's not really a solution to traffic because you're just bringing cars here already that are kind of overloading the roads. And then Bourne, the town of Bourne, having concerns also about what kind of impacts this may have on the town.
Yeah, Bourne really wants to make sure that they're involved in discussions going forward. Selectmen Judy Froman said that there needs to be a full conversation about it. Although these changes might help ease traffic going through Bourne, she wants to make sure that there's no ramifications on town residents that aren't, you know, that are sort of forgotten about as we move forward with the bridges.
As you say, it's a draft, so it's an early look at what may happen.
Yes.
But all of this dependent on the federal government coming up with the money to actually replace the bridges. This is the state's idea of how all these things could connect.
Yeah, a lot of moving parts still that have to be settled. So.
The Dennis Yarmouth School Committee met this week. It was the first meeting after the effort to update the regional agreement failed. And this is your beat for the Cape Cod Times. You have one quote in the article from a school committee member saying, "There's a whole lot of emotion here." And that almost seems like an understatement at this point.
Yeah, I think this has just been going on for so long and so many people, you know, so deeply involved with this and conflicted in so many ways about what might happen next. That Dennis Town meeting a couple weeks ago did turn down a proposal to update the regional agreement. There was a lot hinging on that proposal. It also turned down its assessment as issued by the school district for the upcoming fiscal year. And that really has created kind of a problem for the both towns and the district, because that means that the district's overall budget has failed. Yarmouth passed a $600,000 override this Tuesday in its town election that would have gone toward funding schools. But even though Yarmouth stepped up and sort of passed that, because the overall budget has failed, the school committee has to take a look at that budget again and is going to have to propose a new budget that would go in front of both towns and go back to town meeting.
The budget failed because Dennis did not approve
Correct.
Their portion of it. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. So what had been sort of up for a vote in Dennis was this new regional agreement, which inside that regional agreement, there was a formula that shifted some of the cost to Dennis. And the school committee had also, when they issued their assessments to both towns, they used that new formula to issue the assessment. So Dennis was thinking, you know, their assessment as issued by the school committee was a little bit higher than they wanted to pay. They did approve in Dennis an assessment that was what the current regional agreement, which is the legal document that's in place now, would have assessed the town. They turned down an additional amount. It was about between $400,000 and $500,000, that would have brought that number up to the full amount that the school district has asked for. But even though they approved that lower amount, that still results in a failed budget for the school committee. That started a 30-day window that the school committee now has to adopt a revised budget. And the revised budget could be higher, lower, or the same as the previous budget. They do plan to ask for a 15-day extension because that means they'd have to have this new budget adopted by June 7th, which is kind of right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
So they're planning to ask for an extension on that. Once the school committee agrees to that, they have to put it back to the towns. The towns would then have to hold another town meeting in each town to approve the new assessments. And there's kind of a lot of question about this, about, you know, Yarmouth stepped forward and agreed to this override. Are they going to be asked to pay even more?
Mm-hmm.
Because the current regional agreement, if they go back to funding the schools under the current regional agreement, that would put Yarmouth's total override amount at over $1 million. So school officials are kind of wondering, would Yarmouth then support that, or would they turn it down? And if it doesn't pass the next set of town meetings that they have, then they'll have to be this big, huge district-wide meeting. These are known as like big tent meetings, where everyone in the whole, both, you know, all voters from the two towns come together under a big tent.
And they've done this before.
They've done this before. This is actually considered to be a really extremely rare process, hardly ever used. DY has had two of these meetings in the past couple years. So it wouldn't be a first for the DY district, but it's something that I know they're all trying to avoid. Also, just because of this rejection in Dennis of the regional agreement, that is sort of keeping things up in the air about a lawsuit that was filed by the town of Yarmouth that has jeopardized a lot of funding, about $44.3 million for a new middle school. If they can't resolve that issue by June 30th, there's a potential that they could lose that funding altogether.
We're going to speak right now with Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Holly.
Morning, Steve.
Holly, an art installation event planned for July by the trustees of reservations has quickly ballooned into some controversy. Tell us what's being proposed here and what kind of response it's getting.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, you saw that. Okay.
Yes, this is an art installation that's planned for July, and it's a hot air balloon that's made out of reflective mylar. So when it's inflated, it'll look like this huge mirrored orb in the landscape. And it's part of the Trustees Art in the Landscape series. And it's expected to make trips or to make appearances across the Commonwealth in July, including a couple stops here on the island. But there has been a little bit of opposition from both town officials and community members who are questioning whether this kind of event is appropriate for a wildlife refuge.
It's a giant balloon. Just so people can try to imagine this, if you go to the website, you can see an image of what they project it's going to look like. A giant Mylar balloon that'll take people up for rides, and then they have these music events planned for this evening, right?
Right. Yeah. It's a giant reflective balloon. So it's supposed to reflect the landscape around it. The aim, according to the organizers, is to inspire people to look at their landscape differently and to draw people out to the properties who might not have otherwise gone. It's called New Horizon. The project's called New Horizon, and the artist is Doug Aitken. And as you said, yeah, it's going to also coincide with some other events, some live music, some talks about the future of climate change and the future of creativity. And there will be also some ticketed rides in the balloon for $250. The other events will cost $25 or $40, depending on whether you're a member of the trustees.
Explain some of the concerns that abutters have with all of this.
Yeah, so there's two planned sites that the trustees wanted to host the balloon at. One is in Edgartown at Katama Farm, and that farm is actually owned by the town and leased to the trustees. So the Town Conservation Commission actually considered the issue earlier this month and denied permission to use the balloon. I talked to the conservation agent, Jane Verconda, and she said it's just not a use they want to see at the farm. They don't feel that it's an appropriate spectacle for a serene, tranquil farm environment. But the other events are planned for Long Point Wildlife Refuge, which is owned by the trustees, and that's in West Tisbury. And selectmen did grant permission. They granted event permits and alcohol and beer and wine permits for the events. And in the mornings, those events will include rides in the balloon and kind of a quiet breakfast. And then in the evenings, the more public events with live music and talks.
I thought it was interesting on your website, the comments for this story are very strong and split almost evenly between people who think this is a great opportunity to bring people out to the land and people who feel like this is too much.
Yeah, there's a really strong tradition of conservation on this island. There's a lot of concern with pressures of development about making sure that we preserve the wildlife and preserve these open spaces. There's one longtime trustees member, Kib Bromhall, who was around when Long Point Wildlife Refuge in West Tisbury was actually open to the public. And he said, we didn't want the noise of the outside world intruding on the peace and quiet and sanctity of this nature reserve. This definitely has sparked a conversation that's ongoing about the pressures of public access and wanting people to appreciate the land and also wanting to conserve the land and make sure to protect the wildlife that's there.
That is Holly Pretzky from the Vineyard Gazette. Holly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. And joining us right now from the Cape Cod Chronicle is Tim Wood on the phone. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, town elections this week in Harwich and Orleans. Run down some of the results for us.
Sure. In Harwich, incumbent selectman Michael McCaskill won re-election to a second three-year term. And Stephen Ford, who's a newcomer to local politics but a familiar face around town, he used to work for Congressman Gary Studs way back when and is the brother of longtime town moderator Michael Ford. Stephen Ford won an open seat on the board over challenger Tom Sherry. And in what's considered an upset, first-time candidate Meredith Henderson, a special ed teacher in the Dennis Yarmouth School System, won a one-year unexpired term on the Monomoy School Committee over former selectman Linda Cibula. Voters in Harwich also turned down a $700,000 debt exemption question for road work, which was a bit of a surprise. Turnout there was about 19%. Up in Orleans, Selectman Mark Matheson was returned to office, and first-time candidate Cecil Newcomb also won a seat on the board. And that was the only contested race on that ballot. And voters in Orleans also approved $47 million for wastewater infrastructure, as well as a few other debt exemption questions. And up in Orleans, the turnout was about 27%.
Tim, you have another article this week I want to ask you about. It's about a town resident who received a special honor. She's 105 years old and has been a longtime advocate for human rights. Tell us about her.
Sure. That's Juliet Bernstein, and she was recently named the Mercy Otis Warren Woman of the Year, an honor that's given each year by the Barnstable County Commissioners to a Cape woman who has made significant contributions in the arts or business, education, or community involvement. Now, Juliet definitely deserves this honor. In an interview with us this week, she talked about her life and the social activism that has been very much a part of her life for decades. Even though that activism really didn't get started until she moved to the Cape in the 1970s, for many years before that, she was a nutrition teacher in New York, and she always paid close attention to what was going on. She lived through, if you think about someone who's 105 years old, they lived through a lot of really important events in our country's history, civil rights movement, et cetera. And Juliet always paid attention to that, but she didn't get involved really until she came to the Cape in the 1970s and joined the League of Women Voters. And since then, she's certainly made her views and her activities known here. She's led just a smattering of some of the things she did. She led the drive to have allow women on the all-male Chatham Band back in the 1980s. She worked to have the town here declared a nuclear-free zone, which was approved by town meeting after a number of attempts. And she led any number of vigils and protests, sometimes in defiance of local officials. She, we have one anecdote where the selectman denied her a permit to conduct a vigil in front of the library. This was back in the 90s, and she went ahead and did it anyway, and got a great turnout. And it just is a testament to her. Her energy and her devotion to these topics. And you said she's 105, but she's actually going to be 106 in a couple of weeks. And she still has things she gets passionate about. She's one of our regular writers of letters to the editor. She recently contributed a guest editorial to the paper on the topic of women in politics, which is something she's had near and dear to her heart for many years. And she's certainly a Chatham and a Cape Cod treasure and someone who definitely deserves this recognition.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Steve.
Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times is with me. Kristen, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant is in its final countdown. It's due to shut down for good at the end of this month, but it seems like it may be limping a bit to the finish here. The plant had another issue which forced an unscheduled shutdown earlier this week, and now it's still operating at below power.
Yes. So the reactor at the plant was shut down Friday night a week ago after one of the plant's two circulating seawater pumps was knocked offline. As of Monday, the reactor was still shut down, but it was considered in hot shutdown at zero power while operators worked on the pump. And when it's in hot shutdown, that just means that the reactor and reactor coolant system are kept heated and pressurized, allowing for a fairly quick return to service. Patrick O'Brien, who's a spokesman for Entergy, which is Pilgrim's operator, said Monday that the problem was related to one of three electrical cables that connect to the pump and that the electrical connection has been repaired. However, as of Monday, the plant remained at just 41% of its full power. I'm sorry, that was as of Thursday, the plant was at just 41% of its full power. due to struggles with clogged screens that filter seawater being drawn from Cape Cod Bay to cool the reactor and turbine. And although plant operators usually conduct a thermal backwash to kind of get rid of debris on the screens, O'Brien said that there still hasn't been a decision made on whether a backlash will be done. He said there's actually no plan to get the plant back to 100% power. He said that we'll see the plant well below that for the remainder of its life. And in addition to the problem in the cooling system, the fuel in the reactor has also gone a bit beyond the date when it's usually changed out. And Pilgrim's scheduled to cease operation on May 31st. That's after being in production for 46 years.
It's going to be a big change, but it won't mean the end of questions around that plant, as all that radioactive fuel will continue to be there and be a question for a long time to come. Let me ask you about right whales, because right whale season appears to have ended in Cape Cod Bay, and the Center for Coastal Study is saying that we seem to be seeing more of these endangered whales, and they're staying longer.
That's right. So Charles Stormy Mayo, who's the right whale ecology program director for the center, said there are kind of two trajectories going on here. One is that the total number of right whales in overall is going down fairly steeply, but at the same time, the number who are that are congregating in Cape Cod Bay is actually going up. So it's kind of like a larger percentage of the population is winding up here. The center has studied right whales in the bay for several decades. And those whales, as you said, are considered at risk of extinction in the coming decades along the Atlantic coast due to deaths and injuries from being caught in fishing rope and hit by ships. They have a current population of around 411. So that's not really a whole lot.
Not very many.
Yeah. And they typically travel to Cape Cod Bay to feed in here in the late winter, and they leave by the end of April. So far, the center has confirmed 267 individual right whales seen either by plane or by boat for the current season.
So that, out of 400, yeah. 267 have been here, yes.
That's a lot. That's about 65% of the total estimated population. And they actually think that that number may be low, the number that they saw, because bad weather kept the plane, the spotter plane, on the ground for 2 weeks during the season. So they think maybe there were more here that they just didn't see. Another thing is that the whales are arriving here earlier than before and staying longer. There were some sightings in early December this year, and some observations suggest they may have been here as early as November. Not everyone thinks this is such good news. The length of the time that the right whales are in Cape Cod Bay affects both the speed that commercial fishing vessels can travel and when lobstermen can set up their traps mm-hmm. and fish. So this year, when vessel speed limits would have been lifted, typically around May 1st in the bay, along with bans on lobster traps, the ongoing presence of right whales led state officials to extend those restrictions for more than a week into May. And that extension beyond May 1st led South Shore commercial lobstermen to hold a rally on May 9th in Plymouth. And really what they said is that they're already way behind their competitors getting started at such a late date, and that lobstermen north of Marshfield have been able to lobster without restrictions for quite a bit now. And there are about 200 commercial lobstermen who are affected by this ban, so it's really something that they have concerns with.
We are going to speak right now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Steve.
Casey, sometime back you told us about a Provincetown figure who had lost his home and whose predicament pointed to the difficulty of navigating the human services, particularly on the Outer Cape, where there are so few housing options. You've got kind of an update this week on how that's been going for him.
Yes, thank you. So 9 months ago, Freddie Rocha, who many people know from town where he's wandered Commercial Street for 40 or more years, he was evicted from his family home in September by his two siblings, Mary Wells and Dennis Rocha, who do not live in Provincetown and say they can no longer afford to keep the family home with Freddie in it. So they had him evicted. David Chick, an artist who spends the summers here and sometimes the winters, become friends with Freddie and took it upon himself to put a roof over his head to navigate the social service system to try to help Freddie. And in looking through all of the paperwork, David Chick was able to find a couple documents, which he is now going before the Orleans District Court judge to say that these documents will prove that that Freddie Rocha's siblings had him evicted illegally. One of these documents is the eviction application itself, which has a line that says the person being evicted is not an infant or disabled. And Mary Wells, his sister, apparently did not check anything off on this box. She just signed the paperwork, therefore agreeing that not an infant or disabled. And another piece of paperwork that David found in Freddie's extensive boxes and boxes of clothes that he kept over the years. Another thing he found was a letter from an attorney spelling out the terms of a life estate for the Rocha siblings' mother, Patricia Rocha, who is in a nursing home with dementia. The life estate says upon her death, Mary and Dennis Roche will have control over the home and will decide whether or not Freddie can live there or not. But that is upon her death, and she's still alive, as I said. So, so David was able to get a lawyer to write a letter to Mary Wells pointing these out, and he was in court. Unfortunately, the judge delayed the hearing until June 20th, which is really bad news because they've lost their housing as of today. They were using David Chick was using GoFundMe money to and social service money when he can get it to keep Freddie either in a hotel or in a winter rental with him. He has to live with him because Freddie's needs are very complex. So it's a really really amazing situation, amazing on two levels. One, that there's somebody who would do this for another human being, and also amazing that it appears, even with all that help, that it's still going to be a really uphill battle for this man, Freddie, who everybody knows and who spent his entire life in Provincetown, to be able to stay here.
Mm. Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thank you for that.
Thank you.
With me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Kristen, one of the Cape state representatives saw something happening along the highway that prompted him to file a new bill at the State House that very day. Some quick action, some might say, for the political process.
Timothy Whelan was driving along Route 6 on the West Barnstable stretch of the highway on his way to Boston, and he looked ahead of him and he saw that a truck that was hauling improperly secured recyclables was blowing recyclables and trash all along the road. And Whelan was so infuriated that by mid-afternoon, he had actually filed legislation on Beacon Hill to significantly increase fines that can be levied for trash and other debris that are deposited along the state's highways, primarily from inadequately covered trucks. And so the bill is titled An Act to Reduce Litter on the Highways of the Commonwealth, and it proposes to increase the current fines, which range from $50 to $200 to a flat fine of $1,000. The Sheriff's Department has actually kicked in on this one, and they've said they've been working really hard to keep Route 6 and other roadways clean. And they actually have two crews that work along the highway daily from early spring through the fall, but they say a significant amount of the debris that's picked up actually comes from these uncovered loads from trucks. One of the sheriff's spokesmen said he sees the crews on his way to work picking up trash along Route 28, and then the next day there's more trash in the same place, and that people don't take the time to cover their loads. Whelan and also State Representative Sarah Peek and Randy Hunt, Peek and Hunt have also signed on as joint sponsors of the bill. Their districts also border Route 6, and there's additional co-sponsors who are expected to sign as well this week before it's assigned to a committee for a hearing.
A drug court is starting in Falmouth. This is a fascinating program, something different for people struggling with addiction and in trouble with the law.
Yes, so that drug court actually started yesterday, and defendants in Falmouth are now getting the same chance to attend drug court as those in Fall River and Barnstable District Court, which had started its own drug court in 2002. And the court's being overseen by Falmouth District Judge Christopher Welsh, who has quite a bit of experience with drug court. For 6 years, Welsh led the drug court in Fall River, which he actually started. And he said he saw many defendants graduate from the program, get jobs, find housing, and mend family relationships that had been broken by their addictions. Over the past few months, the Falmouth court has hired a part-time clinician and contracted with a drug testing company. And those are the only two requirements of the program that actually required any additional money. Defendants who opt to plead guilty in drug court can avoid jail time, but they have to adhere to intensive probation and mandatory treatment, along with random drug testing. arresting. And Welch said that multiple police departments across the Cape have also committed officers that are going to be working with the program, and that means that the judge can ask them to find a defendant who may have missed court and kind of help keep tabs on them. Falmouth Police Chief Edward Dunn said that this program is really going to be embraced. He says he hopes it will actually bring a drop in the crime rate as well.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Joining us right now in the studio is WCAI reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
And on with the phone with us right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, Sarah, and Kristen.
Good job, George. let's talk about the decision by the Oak Bluffs Board of Selectmen to remove a pair of plaques from a Civil War statue. We've talked about this in the past. George, start by giving us a little of the backstory here. Tell us about the statue and how these plaques initiated this discussion.
Yeah, so this particular statue was erected in 1891 by Charles Strahan, who incidentally was a newspaper publisher, and he was also a Confederate veteran, and he had relocated to the island after the Civil War and decided that this might be a way to repair things. And so he went about charging subscriptions. Those subscriptions, the money that came in, then went to build this statue. And at one point, a plaque went on the statue that said, "The chasm is closed." And of particular concern to folks now is this phrase, "in honor of the Confederate soldiers." Back in March, there was a vote of the NAACP here on the Vineyard to go to Selectmen and request that that plaque be removed, as well as another one that also made reference to honoring Confederate soldiers. They said that is not something that should be on this particular monument. I think it's important to point out that they weren't saying destroy it. They weren't saying take down the monument. What they were saying is it doesn't belong there. Put it in the museum, the Martha's Vineyard Museum, where it can be put into historical context. Mm-hmm. So there have been a series of meetings about this. The selectmen were approached by the NAACP. There were a couple of contentious meetings about it, and the selectmen decided they wanted to hear from more people, so they set up this public forum, which is what happened earlier this week.
Okay, let me jump in there. They had this public forum earlier this week on Tuesday, and Sarah, you went over for this meeting. Tell us what happened there while you were there.
Sure, yeah. It was a packed meeting. It was at the Oak Bluffs Elementary School cafeteria. I think about 150 to 200 people showed up, and there was over an hour of public testimony, people lining up to speak about their experiences on the Vineyard and how the plaques would impact or have impacted their experiences on the Vineyard. Actually, surprisingly, nobody really spoke up in favor of keeping the plaques. The crowd that showed up was very much pro taking the plaques down. And that is exactly what happened in a very surprising turn of events at the very end of the night after all of this emotional testimony. I don't even think the NAACP was expecting this, but the select board took a vote and very quickly said, "We're taking the plaques down. We're going to put them in a museum." That's it. There were kind of surprised shouts when that vote was made.
We have the sound from that event. Yeah. And we don't have it right now, but you brought it back. And there was an extended hooting and hollering and long sort of applause that went on and on, as though the crowd hadn't really expected this to happen and kind of were trying to process this in the moment that this has happened that quickly.
Yeah, exactly. I think even the head of the NAACP did not expect them to really do this. There had been an option on the table for them to kick this to a vote in April of 2020. And I think that's what a lot of people had come into the meeting thinking would happen. And afterwards, I heard a number of people saying, "I did not expect it to be that easy."
Yeah. George, what's the follow-up on that?
Well, I was going to say, you know, it did take everybody by surprise that this happened, because they were talking about bringing it either to a ballot or to a town meeting. And that would have just prolonged things. We are going into the summer season. You could just imagine we were already inundated with comments and letters to the editor about this issue. And it was very, very contentious. I mean, I think this really does give an opportunity for that chasm to close because a decision has been made. It's not a decision to rewrite history. These plaques are going to the Martha's Vineyard Museum. They have agreed to accept them. So, and they're going to be put into some context. And we're not getting the kind of contentious comments that we were getting previously about this. There's been a couple, but I think people are sort of resolved to the fact that, you know, it was the right decision to be made. And, you know, selectmen, to their credit, they took their time. They heard the comments on both sides, and they made a unanimous decision. I think that also is helpful in all of this. So,
I think somebody mentioned actually at the meeting that they are under the microscope. I think that really put some pressure on the select board, mentioning that as the summer season was approaching, the select board was under the microscope as a lot of wealthy African-American people were looking at coming back. And how would this look for the select board to kind of kick this vote further? I think that was definitely something that I thought made a lot of waves when that was said. There was a bit of a pause there when everyone was like, oh, this has bigger implications outside of just this town hall meeting.
George, do we have a sense of what happens? They're going to remove these plaques and put them in the museum. When does that happen? Is that something that they're moving forward with?
Yeah, well, they haven't said exactly when that will happen. You know, that I'm sure we'll hear about that perhaps at their next meeting in early June. But for right now, you know, the museum was there that night. In fact, Bo Van Riper, who's a historian at the museum, put this all in historical context. And museum officials were there and said that they're going to accept this. So we don't know exactly when that's going to happen. But again, we should hear about that sometime in early June.
George, I want to ask you about a different story. The Times did some special reporting around something called Give Back Day at the high school. Tell us about this and the stories you followed around this.
I got to tell you, every staff member participated in this and willingly participated in this. Martha's Vineyard High School has a Give Back Day. This was the second one that they've done. And they went to over 60 places on the island, 600 students, 100 adults spread out all over the island, hitting every town, almost every nonprofit organization. They did things like beach cleanups. I had the good fortune of going to the Hebrew Center, where some regular ed students and some special ed students were working together to make challah bread. And they went to Camp Jabberwocky, where they were planting flowers and they were installing locks on doors. They went to animal shelters. It was just a great event. I think everybody on staff who went out and did this, when they came back, they just had this good feeling about them. We enjoy doing these types of stories, and we were happy that the school allowed us in on this window of what they were doing in the community that day. It was just it was a special day to go out and be a reporter, I have to tell you.
Mm. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve, and have a good Memorial Day weekend.
And you too.
Thank you.
With us from the Cape Cod Times is Kristen Young. Kristen, the town of Falmouth has a relatively new moratorium on a type of herbicide. Now the town's conservation committee is asking for an exemption. Most of the towns across the Cape and the islands are struggling with this herbicide question, so there's kind of a bigger picture here as well.
Yes. So the Board of Health in Falmouth had instituted a year-long moratorium on the use of glyphosate, which is an herbicide. And it's kind of a controversial herbicide. There are some people who would argue that its use is perfectly safe, and there are others who say that there are some studies coming out that are shown it may cause cancer. Some countries have banned it, and again, some others have not. So in April, the Board of Health decided to have a year-long moratorium on that to give members time to do some research and decide whether to enact a full full-blown regulation. But just this past Monday, the Falmouth Conservation Commission sought variances to that moratorium that would allow them to spray herbicide on 8 properties under its authority. The health officials, though, approved only one of those variance requests, saying that the commission should really look at alternatives to glyphosate use before they would be granted further permission to use it. Prior to the vote on the moratorium, the Conservation Commission had urged health officials against restricting glyphosate use. A Falmouth conservation agent said that they've been using glyphosate since 2000 and that the herbicide has been successful in ridding large swaths of Phragmites so that native species can grow. But the Board of Health only approved one of the commission's variance requests, and that was at Coonamesset Fields, where other methods, I guess, have been exhausted, according to the health agent. Coonamesset Fields totals 42 acres, and it's located off of Nathan Ellis Highway. The Conservation Commission is looking to treat 11 of those acres there with the herbicide this summer using a boom sprayer in high-density areas and then backpack sprayers in moderately dense areas. Even Eversource, though, has stopped using boom spraying on its rights of ways in response to substantial outcry from local officials and residents. There's been ongoing concern over the herbicide application for several years in communities across the Cape, and as of now, only backpack sprayers are used by Eversource to treat weeds and overgrowth.
And the idea that boom spraying would be more indiscriminate.
Yes, yes. But conservation officials told the Board of Health Monday that the growth is really difficult to reach there, and that's why the boom sprayers would be needed. Laura Kelly, who's the president of an organization called Protect Our Cape Cod Aquifer, has really been the one urging these town officials, as you mentioned, across Barnstable County to adopt municipal bans or regulations that restrict the use of glyphosate products on town-owned properties. And so far, Harwich, Wellfleet, East Ham, Chatham, Provincetown, Sandwich, and Falmouth with its moratorium have adopted some form of restriction. Kelly says, though, that the Conservation Commission here in Falmouth should wait for the year-long moratorium to end and for the Board of Health to make a long-range plan, and that in the meantime, Phragmites are not going to take over the town.
I think a lot of people might be familiar with this glyphosate. It's one of the herbicides in Roundup.
Yes.
The weed killer Roundup that people can typically buy for their home properties.
That's correct. And, a lot of people have used this for years. The World Health Organization, though, in 2015, released a study that it was kind of not particularly definitive. It said the chemical probably causes cancer. However, the Environmental Protection Agency on April 30th in a press release said that agency has found no risks to public health from the proper use of glyphosate. You may have heard about this, though. Recently, 3 California juries during the last year have found in favor of people who have claimed to have gotten cancer from using Roundup, which is a weed killer that contains glyphosate, and they've been awarded millions of dollars in damages. So kind of a lot of things weighing in on both sides here.
And the Conservation Commission had been looking at other sites around Falmouth that they wanted to spray that they didn't get permission to do.
That's right. So they were looking at the Bog Reservoir on John Parker Road, areas around the lower bog on John Parker Road, 2 acres of on Peterson Farm, and about 4 acres near wetlands and forested areas off Blacksmith Shop Road, and a third of an acre near wetlands by Coonamesset Pond Beach, and also an acre and a half on Seaford Farms parcel and a former forest on Adamasset Road.
I thought it was interesting that the town's tree warden and park superintendent, who obviously is taking care of a large pieces of property in this way, has decided that they're not going to even ask to use this.
That's right, yes.
Let me ask you about a bill to reauthorize the Advisory Commission to the Cape Cod National Seashore, which represents local towns. It's been reintroduced in Congress by our Congressman Bill Keating. The commission has been terminated for a while now.
Yes. So if this bill goes through, this would reauthorize the commission for another 10 years. Keating says he expects the bill to move forward, although there was a hearing on Wednesday where National Park Service Deputy Director Daniel Smith repeated the Interior Department's recommendation, which it had made in December, that the commission should not be authorized or that its scope of responsibility should be reduced. Smith said that the Park Service does not support the bill. Keating also spoke at the hearing, and what he's saying is really that the House version of the bill, he's saying that the Commission has played a critical role in helping the seashore and communities in the area to work together to solve problems, to avoid conflicts, and that it's really a useful commission and needs to keep going forward. The House version of this bill had passed unanimously last year, and Keating said he expects things to go smoothly against this Congress. The next step would either be marking up the bill or a vote on the floor. Just for a little background here, the 58-year-old advisory commission typically meets with the seashore superintendent about 4 to 6 times a year to hear reports on land development, protection of natural resources, and other things. Members are volunteers, and they represent the 6 towns within the boundaries of the seashore, as well as Barnstable County, the state, and the Interior Department. In September, the typical 10-year authorization of the board expired. The House had passed a bill in December that would extend it to the commission till 2028, but a similar version did not emerge from the Senate that time. So
there's a sense that there's some real politics at play here on a federal level, and one of the things that the Interior Department has pointed to in their concern about this board was that it may have potential to weigh in on commercial uses within the park.
Yes. So Mary Jo Avalar, who represents Provincetown, has said, though, that the board has never had the authority to tell the superintendent what to do, that they make these recommendations and then, you know, they kind of all work together to reach the decisions, even though the Interior Department has said that the Interior Department wants to eliminate a clause that would require the Secretary of the Interior to consult with the commission on permission for commercial uses.
Right. And they're saying that actually we don't have that authority already.
That's
so
correct.
It doesn't seem like this should be the sticking point to this commission, which has been there, which was the first of the commissions that were set up for the National Park Service. So
yes,
it has this historical precedent already and so much support from the towns and the delegation. Let's talk about Herring Cove Beach parking lot since we're out there on the Cape Cod National Seashore. The parking lot is reopening after being part of a big renovation project for the seashore.
Yes, so starting today, motorcyclists and bicyclists can use a renovated access road to the northern Herring Cove Beach parking lot. That is a popular but heavily eroded parking lot, and it serves the north portion of the beach. It's being renovated, and it's expected to reopen by July 4th. Right now, visitors to the beach, which is off Moores and Province Land Roads, can park in the large southern lot that's protected by the dunes. And by July 4th, parking is expected to be available in the new northern lot, which is known for its drive-up views. And it's really easier there for visitors to unload their beach gear closer to the water's edge and to get down to the water. Both the Province Lands Road and the 208-space northern parking lot have been moved inland due to severe erosion from winter storms. And this has been a big project. It cost $3.3 million, and it's been about a year and a half's worth of construction. So there's a lot of excitement here to see this sort of wrap up. The entire expanse of the beach will be open for Memorial Day weekend, as it has been all along from the southern lot. But visitors are asked to stay away from things that are still sort of in development in the northern lot.
So this is such a popular lot, as you say, especially for people who want to come out and watch the sunset here.
Yes, that's correct. And there's actually been some estimates that say that this ongoing infrastructure has had a direct drop on visitation at Herring Cove. Annual visitor counts for the past few years have been in the range of 850,000. And in the last 2 years, that dropped to about the mid-500,000s because of this ongoing infrastructure changes. And there's also some other projects that are popping up at area beaches that are kind of in the stages of wrapping up. At Head of the Meadow Beach in North Tro, there's the footprint is still there for repair materials of a nearby bike path. That's been reduced to create more parking for this weekend. At Marconi Beach in Southwest Wellfleet, a final inspection is expected today that would allow beachgoers to park their cars in the large lot on the bluff and then use this newly built set of stairs to reach the beach below. And access to the beach there from the stairs has been cut off over the past winter. At Nauset Light Beach in Northeast Ham, there's some ongoing fixes to the bathrooms there. There's a design phase underway for a new $2.1 million bathhouse and parking lot reconfiguration.
A lot going on out there to prepare the park for the summer and kicking off this weekend here with Memorial Day weekend.
That's correct.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Kristen Young from the Cape Cod Times. Kristen, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Steve.
And thanks to our other contributors. We heard from Holly Pretzky at the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we were joined by WCAI reporter Sarah Mises-Tan. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening. Thank you.